Angela, I wanted to start off by saying thank you for your time. I really appreciate you being here and sharing your experiences with us. The work you do for the adopting a community is so incredibly important, and I can't wait to learn more about it. If at any
Thank
point you
you.
feel uncomfortable, feel free to stop me and we can end it whenever you want. Besides that, I'm very, very honored to have you here today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
To start, Angela, could you please tell me how you started your work with the adoption experience and how has that evolved into your work today?
Well, as an adoptee, I think it started real early on as a transracial adoptee, meaning my parents are white and I'm black, so we were very conspicuous. So we had lots of people inquiring often about not just me, but many of my siblings. My parents adopted a lot of kids. So for a long time, I've been involved as a teenager. I started speaking publicly at different events, primarily for adoption agencies. And my work at that time was, I think I was sharing, gosh, that was a long time ago, but I think I was talking at that time about the perils of closed adoptions. And I don't think I knew that's what I was talking about at that time, but I was talking about wishing I knew more about my story, about my birth parents. And so in retrospect, I can say that I was talking about the harms of closed adoptions.
Yeah, I've been following your work on social media. You're very vocal about your experience as a Black transracial adoptee growing up in an environment where you were a racial minority. How did that shape your understanding of identity and influence your perspective on transracial adoptions?
Immeasurably. I was usually the only Black person in a room. The city where I grew up, Bellingham, Washington, in the 90s was predominantly white. It's a college town, so the diversity would fluctuate throughout the year because of the students and professors coming into town. But in general, pretty white, middle class, lovely city. It's great in between Seattle and Vancouver, Washington. And but being the only Black person in the room, oftentimes the only adoptee in a room, the only transracial adoptee in a room other than my siblings, I think that just meant that I had to learn about how to educate others at a really early age. People were often very curious about my Blackness and how I got to a city like Bellingham. And so I was needing to teach other people about really like the history of Black America and how that interacts with transracial adoption. It wasn't enough for me to just say, yeah, I guess I just ended up across the country from my birth state of Tennessee, but instead I wanted to share like why that is and how that relates to the Jim Crow era and redlining, segregation, even things like mass incarceration of Black folks. And basically I wanted to put it in context for people that there is a reason why so many white folks are adopting Black and brown kids, and we don't see the inverse very often. So I don't think I was having that conversation like in middle school. In high school, I started to have some of that awareness and desire to set the record straight. I think this primarily came because people would say to me, "How awesome that you're adopted. You must be so thankful, to get away from a bad situation." When in reality, I didn't even really know why I was adopted. And so it didn't make sense to me how other people could assume that I got a better life. And so, in trying to deconstruct that, it was really clear that a better life equals being in closer proximity to whiteness.
Yeah, So just to pivot, you talked about this idea of being grateful. This past April, you published your book, You Should Be Grateful. Angela, this is a truly insightful and informative book. By the way, I would encourage anybody who wants to understand the nuances of kinship and belonging to read this book. How do you envision a more inclusive and adoptee-centered adoption process in an ideal world? What steps do you believe are essential to achieve this transformation?
Thank you for your kindness about my book. First of all, my hope for a more adoptee-centered, I shouldn't even say adoptee-centered. I just want to say my hope is that we can start to understand the value of preserving families. So adoption is really a subtraction problem, and we erase one set of families and replace them with another set of parents, and I don't understand why we can't have it be an addition problem, that perhaps we have a set of parents that aren't able to fulfill all the duties to parenting. Do we need to terminate their parental rights in order to keep a child safe? I don't know that we need to do that. I think we can add more community people supports around a child, and perhaps that can be helpful and healthy. I've seen this model in the Treehouse Foundation out of Boston, SOS Children's Villages all over, but they have a place in Chicago. And essentially, it's like communal, a more communal approach versus the nuclear family structure of, let's take this kid out and put them in this other family. I think it's the way I view inclusion is, first of all, if we can humanize biological parents quite a bit more, and we're able to see them not as just bad people, but instead people who are in precarious situations, people who need more support. I think there's a very small percentage of people who truly are unsafe and don't want their children. I think that percentage is really not equal to the amount of adoptions we have, and that makes me really sad. So instead, let's think of a different way. I do a lot of work in the openness concept. So if an adoption has happened, how can we make sure that the child is still connected to their biological families? And that is, I think that's a good solution, but it's not absolutely the best, because the adoptive parents still have a lot of the control and power to say, we don't want to meet with the birth parents, or they are dangerous, or they are scary, or they aren't appropriate. When in reality, that may not always be the case. From my work and my consulting, more often than not, it's a matter of discomfort that the adoptive parents are really uncomfortable because it's maybe across racial lines or across class status that makes having a true relationship really unusual. And that, I think, is not a great reason to keep a child away from their biological family.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I think the ideas you touch upon are so important. And in the adoptive world, there's like a dominant narrative that adoptees are at the receiving end of a giving relationship and that they should feel inherently grateful. And we touched upon it briefly in our conversation. You also addressed this through a book. Could you please elaborate on the importance of understanding that the current process is a subtractive problem? What are some like other stereotypes or myths that cloud the current adoptee experience?
Other myths, in addition to, the message that we get from media, which is typically kind of a fairy tale narrative that all is better after you're adopted. I think other myths that I've seen within the adoption world is attributing all negative stereotypes to birth parents and all positive stereotype or all positive traits. So I'll say that again, attributing all negative traits to birth parents and all positive traits to the adoptive parents. So this nature versus nurture debate, which is valid, is really black and white and binary when it comes to the birth parents, which is a real pity because there are so many aspects of nature that have more to do with positive traits, but we just don't attribute it that way. So I think that's a real sad truth. Other, you asked about myths. Is that
And
right?
yeah, I'm missing other like stereotypes. For example, like we talked about the grateful narrative.
Yeah, other stereotypes is the saviorism, just that you're saved from a bad place to a better place. That if an adoptee wants to know their biological parents, then they're mad at their adoptive parents or they're rebelling, which is absolutely not true. Myths that adoptive parents are noble, humble saints that kind of can do no wrong when in reality they're human just like all of us. And that gets tricky when adoptees have adoptive parents who divorce and then they feel a lot of shame in how would they articulate that to their biological parents if they ever reunited with them. That can feel like a big thing because there's this grand promise that sometimes birth parents as well believe that their child will be in a very stable environment versus the natural rhythm of relationships and life. Yeah, so those are a few.
Yeah.
There's a stereotype about angry adoptees, which is pretty much any adoptee who's kind of speaking out without first showing an immense amount of gratitude to their adoptive parents first.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing these like limiting narratives. I think there's so many that shroud the adoptee community that needs to be dispelled for this process to be an inherently human-centered process. We also talked a bit about the perception of birth parents. When people outside the adoptee community read your book, what do you want them to take away?
Oh, I worked so hard to portray my biological mother and father as more than just this really tough moment in their lives when my birth mother was pregnant and homeless and not sure what to do with multiple of her pregnancies. So I'm hoping that when people read my book, that they start, I think I do a little bit of sharing around my ghost kingdom, which is a term coined by Betty Jean Lifton. That's basically this hypothetical world where adoptees go when they imagine who their birth parents are. And I talked about my ghost kingdom being Magic Johnson is my birth father, who is a famous basketball star back in the day and has a humongous smile. And so I talked about this being potentially my birth father, even though he's not, because of his basketball athleticism, which I have, and then his huge smile, which I also have. And just in that anecdote, my hope is that people can see birth parents for more than just that difficult incident, but that they are humans with like humor and hobbies and likes and dislikes. And that would be, if we were able to do that, I think that would really move the needle forward. That we aren't just thinking of birth parents as criminals in jail. But oh yeah, someone might be incarcerated and they also love chicken noodle soup, you know? And that's like an important detail to humanize the birth parent community.
Wow, yeah, I do think that your writings especially are working towards a crafting a new, more inclusive narrative. And also this idea of Ghost Kingdom is super interesting. I have to do more research, more reading on that. Angela, your work has echoed throughout the field of adoption, particularly among younger adoptees who may not possess the same clarity about the whole experience as you do. That brings me on to my next question. Can you please tell me more about what motivated you to fund the Adoptee Mentorship Society?
Yes. When my documentary Closure was making the rounds, I would occasionally go and do a Q&A for the audience after the film. And when I did that, I would meet so many adoptees. They would come running up to the stage and say, "Thank you for sharing your story. I wish I could do the same, but I could never speak publicly about wanting to find my birth parents because my adoptive parents would be hurt. My adoptive parents would feel like I was like rebelling against them or no longer loyal to them." And so as I continued to hear these stories, it was perplexing to me because my adoptive parents were in the crowd whenever they could, and they were just proud and glad to be there. It was interesting because I would see so many people go over to my adoptive parents and say things like, "Are you okay with how Angela portrays adoption?" And they were really like trying to console my adoptive parents, who were like, "We're happy. She wants to talk about this. It's great." So that was a big dichotomy that I was noticing. And I started virtually mentoring a lot of these adoptees who came to the screenings, saying things like, "I could never talk about this publicly because it would hurt my adoptive parents' feelings." So in doing some of those virtual mentoring, I just kept amassing more and more and more adoptees who were saying the same thing. And so I decided to create groups and mentor them in a group setting, and that was really powerful because some of them would say, "I've never been in a room with only adoptees before," and that experience of being understood without having to explain themselves was like completely foreign, and it just made me feel great, but also like this is a need. Some transracial adoptees that I was mentoring had never heard the word transracial adoption before, so they were like, "Wow, there's a word for this." Things like the Ghost Kingdom, things like ambiguous loss, disenfranchised grief, like all of these terms that I knew and gave me some peace in feeling that sense of a lack of belonging. It was new and revolutionary for others. So I kept doing that and didn't really realize I was mentoring so many, like 280 adoptees at a certain point. And so some of my advisors said, "Let's try to build this out, scale it up. Maybe we can train other adoptees to mentor other adoptees." And I thought that was a great idea. And so that's currently where we're at. We have incorporated it as a 501c3 nonprofit, and we have trained four adoptees to mentor. And it's been a little rocky, as any new endeavor is, but the need is so great.
Yeah, I'm excited to see where Adoptee Matters Society goes to, but I think the idea you have for it to be like a self-sustaining mentorship program is just so important because all of these adoptees do need the support and resources that you are providing. I do want to come back to the Adoptee Matters Society, but something you said was just so interesting. Adoptees tell you that they found it difficult to share their stories, whereas your decision to publicize your complete complex adoptee stories is incredibly impactful. How do you navigate the vulnerabilities of sharing such a personal journey?
I have really learned about boundaries and that to differentiate between me sharing my personal vulnerable stories for the sake of just appeasing everyone's curiosity is not what I do. I think I used to do that where people were just so curious, and so I would meet their curiosity by just blabbering. Now I feel way more in control, and I have utilized the strategic story sharing, or some people call it ethical story sharing models, where you're really aware of what stories you're sharing and what the purpose is. So, are you sharing a certain aspect of your story to educate others, to influence policy and legislation, to stimulate conversation? Like, to know the why is really important, and that's something I've worked really hard to do. So now I feel very comfortable sharing, and I know my boundaries of what pieces are not available for public fodder. And I feel very empowered when I'm at an event and people ask a question that I don't share, I feel very strong. I feel very proud to be able to say that's a private, that's something that I don't share, or that's like my birth parents' story, so I don't have permission to share that. I feel like those answers are helping to teach and mentor others to know you can have boundaries around your story. And so I'm proud to offer that too.
Yeah, adoption experiences are just so multifaceted. There's so many crossroads and so many intertwining individuals. So balancing parts of
Yes.
your story you want to keep yourself is very impactful. So yeah, back to
It's hard to, it takes work to, like you said, so many of the stories are intertwined. It takes work to figure out which part of your story is yours. I think I do
yeah.
this work with adoptive parents a lot to help them figure out which, what aspects belong to them and what aspects don't belong to them. That is a very respectful process. I really love when folks do that work. And I think it feels freeing actually to everybody.
Yeah, it's a very empowering process to share stories, but also understand which stories are yours to share. So yeah, thank you for
Yes.
sharing that. Back to like the process of organizing the Adoptee Mentoring Society. What are the main challenges you face in establishing and growing these mentorship initiatives?
I would say the biggest hurdle that we're having right now is the training of the adoptee mentors. There are so many adoptees who are very passionate about wanting to become a mentor, to help, to give back, to be something that they wished they had when they were growing up. But then the reality of mentorship is a little bit different. There's the issue around mentors being kind of triggered by things that the mentee will say. And if they hadn't yet processed that, then it's hard sometimes for the mentors to keep the focus on the mentee, which is absolutely important. So in psychology, people call that the parallel process. So I have been revamping our training modules to support our mentors to be able to have a separate place to process their own story, so that they're not needing to do it in a mentor session and they can focus fully on the mentee. I think their other aspect is when when you're being mentored, you do have a lot of light bulb moments and kind of immediate gratification. It's exciting, you feel seen. Being a mentor, you don't have those moments. And sometimes there's an expectation that that's if I, you know, if I loved being mentored so much, of course I'll love being a mentor to others. And that's just not true. It's a completely different position. And so I need to do a better job of setting expectations, I think, for what that's going to look like. There's one of the scariest parts for me of building this is how to end well. So I've been working with a lot of other mentoring organizations around this, but the tricky part is for adoptees, abandonment issues are so deep within our veins that it would be very easy to replicate that if someone doesn't show up for a scheduled session. You know, that could do a lot of harm to an adoptee, and I just don't want that. When I was just doing all the mentorship on my own, I would never miss a mentor session that I had scheduled, no matter what. It's a really high bar, but for this specific identity, it has to be that way. Rescheduling can feel, it can feel really triggering. And so that's been something I've had to work really hard with my mentors around is we can't take this lightly. You schedule a session, you've got to be there.
Yeah, you talk about like this these potential triggers that it's very, very important because for adoptees that's an incredibly vulnerable part of their identity. I also know that you study psychology at Seattle Pacific University. As a university student myself, I'm curious as to how this academic background carries over into your continued work at the Adoptee Mentoring Society. I know you talked a bit about it. I would just love for you to elaborate more about how that background assists you in your role.
Well, I think human development and understanding, I think the biggest support that my undergrad degree has had is probably more around the different ages and developmental stages for adoptees. So I mentor adoptees ages 12 to 16 as a group, and then 17 to 22 as a group, and 23 and up. And there are very different focuses for those age groups that I like to focus on when mentoring. But in addition to that, understanding that development is a little bit different for adoptees, especially those who perhaps were in foster care for many years and or those who had no ability to process their adoption within their family. Kind of, I think the overlapping and intersectional identities, learning about that in psychology has been really helpful here to be nimble, to adjust, to know that a one size fits all model is just not going to work. When I had studied kind of the prefrontal cortex, that and the amygdala and the fear center, I think those have stayed with me as I understand that every mentor session not only has to line up with their developmental age, but also thinking about their history and their past and how that plays into it.
I want to shift focus now to the Closure documentary. It's a truly fantastic film. It touched upon so many topics in just 72 minutes. Like, wow. It was moving, like how you navigated meeting your biological family in combination with your work establishing the Adoptee Mentoring Society. Could you please explain what adoptive parent curiosity means for adoptees? You talked a bit about crossing social lines and social classes and the idea of this ghost kingdom. So I'm curious to learn more.
Can you ask that question again? So sorry.
Yeah, no worries. In combination with your work establishing the Adoptee Mentoring Society, could you please explain what adoptive parent curiosity means for adoptees?
Yeah, that's a big question. Because of the inherent power differential that adoptive parents have over their child, even if the child is a teenage or is an adult, we often, the adoptive parent's voice is really loud for not just us adoptees, but society. There are, it can feel like walking on eggshells when interacting, when adoptees interact with adoptive parents, because for so many of the adoptive parents, they're just oozing this sense of, I did the best I could. I didn't want to harm you. I thought adoption was a beautiful thing. I didn't know it would be so complicated. Like, there's a lot of that sort of language, which can make it really hard for an adoptee to express themselves. Thankfully, I have been in contact with a lot of adoptive parents who understand the need for adoptee to adoptee relationships, especially white adoptive parents of black and brown kids who understand that they can't possibly meet all of their kids' needs and that their kid is going to need racial representation, racial mirroring, and that they will never be able to provide that. So a lot of adoptive parents, thankfully, are fully embracing that concept and therefore are encouraging their children to be part of programs like mine. But it still doesn't come without it's just that heavy layer of fear that we're going to hurt them.
Yeah, in your documentary, you also talk about your own experience, you reuniting with your birth family. What was that process like? If you do feel comfortable, I invite you to share your most memorable moment. This could be like an unexpected challenge or a surprising discovery throughout the entire filming process.
Well, the filming process in and of itself was a surprise. My husband is the filmmaker, and we had talked about getting home video footage just for me because this was such a big moment. And I thought, if I only see my birth mother once and that's it, I want it captured on camera so I can look at her forevermore. However, at the time, I was working at an adoption agency with a lot of families who said things like, "We're going to be the best adoptive parents ever, and our kid won't even need to know their birth parents because they will have all their needs met through us." And so I had had really loving adoptive parents, had my needs met, and knew that that wasn't enough. So my husband really was like, "Why don't we share of what we're capturing, some of your process with your clients?" And so I decided to do that. And that's how this kind of morphed into becoming a documentary. My husband thought, I'm going to go get some editing software. And so he did that. I'm going to get some nicer filming equipment. So he did that. And we were just really surprised when Netflix and Hulu and iTunes called and wanted to put it on their platforms. It was. We crowdfunded maybe I think $20,000 to help with some of the filming costs, but really didn't have a budget. And so it was a surprise and a beautiful thing to understand that people really wanted the adoptee's perspective of this of a reunion. But it caught us all off guard, and I certainly would have had some different fashion choices if I knew it was going to be a big thing.
Yeah, you talked about like crowdfunding and like your husband maybe like picking up like equipment and things. I'm just curious, was this you guys' first time working with the film or working with like this different types of media to represent the adoptee experience?
Yes. My husband is a filmmaker now, but at
Oh
that time he was not. He was working in property
wow.
management, he was working in real estate, and just had a budding interest. And so that catapulted his career, which is fantastic. And we've done some work together in that regard. But no, this was our first time.
It is a great film to be like a first time experience. Like I would not have believed it if you did not tell me because it's just received so many like accolades as well. Like it's a major part of representing the adoptee community. If you could rewind before to before filming this documentary and meeting your birth family, what are some things you would do differently? And what is something that you'd wish you'd known?
Good question. I don't know that there was a lot different that I could have done. I waited until I was 21, which is the age that Tennessee allows people to get their original birth certificates. So I was, when I turned 21, I applied for that so, because that could show my biological mother's full name. So I applied and didn't get it. They said no still. And so then I had to just take matters into my own hands. The resounding question that still is with me is kind of whose right? Do I have a right to meet my biological mother? And does she have a right to not let me know her at the same time? I think this is the tension. And in trying to find her, I was always aware that I wanted her to be able to say no. And at the same time, I did feel like I had a right to know some more aspects of my story. So that tension is ongoing. I think the way to mitigate that is through this advocacy work that I'm doing now, which is openness and make sure people know each other sooner so that we can make our preferences known and we don't have to wonder about our health history or medical history or things that are very important. So I'm not sure that I would even do anything different, but it's just an important piece that to keep front and center.
I wanted to ask more about how the revelations and like meeting with your birth parents impact your relationships with your adoptive family. Like, did it impact your broader understanding of the concept of family itself?
Yeah. I mean, it definitely strengthened my relationships with my adoptive parents going through the search process. And that's actually what research shows too, is that adoptees gain greater attachment with their adoptive parents when the adoptive parents are along for the ride. So that certainly happened for me. I do have a more expansive and inclusive definition of family now, but I think growing up, I had foster siblings and foreign exchange students that were living with us, and of course, all the adoptions in my family. So I do think my parents instilled that quality quite early on that families can look very different ways. So it wasn't a far stretch for me to now consider all my birth family as part of our family, and my adoptive parents do as well. They send all my birth siblings, birthday cards and all that kind of thing, and it feels right.
Because your adoption was closed, which we touched upon briefly earlier, the Tennessee law posed as an obstacle in your search for your birth parents. I want to give you the space to talk a bit about your advocacy work. What is your current process of that? What's your ultimate goal? And how did this experience with the closure documentary play a role in it?
Well, I'll answer that last question first. There are a lot of other adoptees doing this work prior to my film coming out. What this showed me is the power of stories, personal stories, that really hits home for people versus perhaps an academic report. People really love storytelling. And so I have used that in my work ongoing, whether it's through podcasts, other films. Some of the work that I'm focused on is thinking about whether or not we need to terminate parental rights in order for a child to be adopted. I'm also working hard on family preservation issues, so helping agencies understand their own biases around child protective services and removing a child from their parents' home. Sometimes that decision is made because of subconscious biases. And so I'm trying to work on that. And that carries over to current adoptive parents who've already adopted their children. I'm trying to help them understand the ways racism plays out and how important it is to just admit and be comfortable with the fact that there is an aspect of racism that's at play inevitably within a transracial adoption, power differential. And lastly, the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act is really a frustrating one that I'm not doing a ton of work around, but I often like to educate people about what it is, and I do think it should be repealed. And essentially, this is a legislation that says for any adoption agency that receives federal funding, they cannot mandate prospective adoptive parents to learn about culture or race. It can be an elective, like an added class, but it can't be required in the same way that other pieces are required, and I feel like that's a real big disservice.
Yeah. I was also wondering what's next for your role as a filmmaker?
Currently working on a documentary with a agency in LA about the issue of over-medicating foster youth. So, there is a phenomenon where kids in foster care, their records don't always transfer with them wherever they go in whichever home they're moved to. And so some of our foster youth are immunized several times when they should have only gotten an immunization once. Sometimes there's foster kids who are given medication as more of a form of behavioral control versus what they actually need. And that can have really dire consequences for the rest of their lives. So I'm working with a team on a documentary around that. And I think that's my only film in process right now.
Yeah, what got you into this like issue surrounding foster care? Because I know you as a transracial adoptee, your work with adoptees is inherently connected. What about with foster care youth?
Well, I was in foster care for a year, and that was an incredibly important time in my life, right after I was born to a year old. And I had loving foster parents who did not do that thing where they said, "We can't attach, because we're going to lose her." Instead, they loved me really well. And that has stuck with me because I think I owe my ability to have healthy attachments to their care at that time. I've been married for 14 years, and I think that's partly because of their love at that time. So, yeah, I'm definitely very involved in the foster care community, and especially around the issue of kids aging out of foster care without home, without a family. I mean, it's related to all of this work around openness and the inclusive, expansive definition of family, because I don't feel like you need to have a legal status in order to care for children. And so to have people aging out of the system, or to think that a state can be responsible for meeting a child's needs, is wild to me. A state cannot be a prudent parent. And that's why, for the medication issue, that's why this happens. So that's where the overlap of foster care really happens for me. I also am the host of a podcast called Innovate, where I interview individuals who've been named Re-envisioning Foster Care Champions, and I had this honor as well. And it's anyone who has been in foster care and is now working to improve the system. So that's been a thrilling time to interview people who just have very innovative ideas about how to change the system.
Yeah, openness seems to be a recurring theme echoed throughout your work. In your Adoptees
Yes.
Next Door podcast, which I know is another podcast of yours, you
Yes.
said that you want to shift societal perceptions through adoptee podcasts. What common themes or other issues surrounding the adoptee community necessitate this shift in public perception? Like, why do you think
Yeah.
societal perception needs to be changed?
Well, and I think because there is a desire to latch on to a single story, like one adopt if people hear one adoptee's story, it's really common for them to think that is everybody's story and everyone's opinion. And so for my podcast, The Adoptee Next Door, my goal and my mission is to shift that, to understand that adoptees are as varied as we all are individuals. And there some adoptees may want to go do a search and reunion like I did, and others may be really content with getting DNA results that tell them more about their ancestry, and both are okay. And so I think of Chimamanda Adichie's TED Talk. She's an author, and she had this TED Talk called The Danger of a Single Story. And that is always echoing in my head when people look at me as the standard for what all adoptees think. And I'm like, absolutely not. And so it's important for me to amplify adoptee voices to get more perspectives out there and hopefully have society validate them as true, real, and believe them.
Yeah, the adoptee experience is a complex network consisting of adoptees, adoptive families, and birth parents, among others. How do you account for the experiences and voices beyond the adoptees themselves?
Well, birth parent voices are really quiet. Well, I shouldn't say quiet. They're just not heard, not listened to, not amplified. So I would love that to be the next generation of voices that we hear. Again, I think there's this desire for people to find their perfect version of the birth parent, or, and usually the perfect version is somebody who is totally assimilated into the culture to which the person is exists within, and that isn't fair or wide-ranging. And so I know of a few really great organizations that are doing good work for birth parents, and I hope to see that continuing in the future. I'm thankful for things like TikTok. TikTok is real loud around adoptee voices, and I think that's fantastic. Foster youth as well. And I was recently talking to some judges who didn't realize that youth and foster care were talking about their rights on TikTok. And I thought that was fascinating and a little disheartening, because we need our systems to like talk to each other,
Integrate, yeah.
integrate, and that isn't happening just yet.
Yeah. I want to shift gears a little bit back to your own personal journey. Angela, you previously worked as a domestic infant adoption care worker. What inspired you to create the post-adoption department? How did you begin recognizing a need for post-adoption support or like services?
Oh my goodness. I couldn't believe that at the agency I worked at, and then many others, they have a tagline that says adoption is a lifelong journey. And yet, while working within the agency, I saw how all supports end once an adoption is finalized. And that was true for birth parents too. So we at times would be supporting birth parents financially, helping with their rent, while they were pregnant. And when I was working at an agency, I saw that how that support would end right when a baby was placed for adoption. No longer would we be supporting birth parents in ways that were absolutely essential. And that really broke my heart. And I think about all birth parents who aren't afforded a way to process what has happened and how that actually impacts openness. So we get back to this concept, but I think about my own birth mother, who in many ways is very stuck in that moment of her trauma when I was born, and has a really hard time really believing that I'm an adult, that she's really still looking for her baby. And I think she said that in the documentary, "I'm looking for my baby." And that is a direct result of not offering post-adoption services. It's a the adoption agencies are very, it can almost be looked at as an industry, commodities, supply and demand, and a business. So once the business transaction is completed, like the child has been in the new home and legal documents are signed, then moving on to the next. And that's just not going to work. There's way too many ongoing issues that need to be supported. So that's where my focus and ultimately moving to become the director of post-adoption services at a different agency stemmed from.
Yeah, Angela, you have such an inspiring array of adoptee-centered work. You foster transparent and inclusive dialogue surrounding the adoptee experience. But I wanted to ask, are you personally continuing to learn more about these different complexities of your identity, or is that journey sort of complete for now?
Oh goodness, I'm always learning and things are always shifting and changing. Something I think that's really common for adoptees, that's actually written about in this new adoptee consciousness model, which is was conceived by Jaeron Kim, Susan Bronco Alvarado, a couple other adoptee researchers, is understanding the ways that our adoptions impact us at kind of key milestones in our lives. So, for many people, if an adoptee chooses to become pregnant, that's a time when they might feel a lot of things about their adoption resurface. Birthdays are often complex and might trigger thoughts about our own birthdays. I certainly have that each year. I think about the day of my birth and what that must have been like, and not just an automatically joyous time. My birth mom is getting older, and so there are lots of thoughts that come with an aging parent. My birth father passed away 3 years ago, and so that made me think about the fact that we only had 7 years together and that he never had the opportunity to even know I was alive before then. So certainly there's just life events and milestones that make all of this come back to the fore and make me rethink and edit my beliefs and worldview. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, are there any specific projects you hope to pursue in the future?
I have a lot of ideas for projects,
What
yes.
gets you most like fired up? Which project gets you fired up?
Gosh, there's so many. I'm pretty excited about this Re-envisioning Foster Care conference that I hosted in Boston this past month and doing it again. I'm really excited. It is a conference that's developed solely by people who had lived experience in the foster care system. So the conference just feels different because the focus is not, it's not like so ambiguous and we lead differently. So that is really exciting. Let's see. I think still focusing on the Adoptee Mentoring Society is, it gets me excited, trying to make it stronger, make the training components better, get new partners involved and have more collaboration opportunities. I think our adoption professional community is a little bit siloed, and I hope that perhaps my nonprofit can change that in a little ways, like just to be very collaborative. So that makes me excited.
Yeah, next time I'm in Boston, I'll make sure to check out the conference. It sounds like a very, very inclusive conversation that you're fostering.
Yeah.
What advice would you give to younger people wanting to participate or contribute to adoptee activism?
To find other adoptees to connect with first, that it can be a very lonely and crucifying journey if we don't have our people. You know, I regularly get emails that are not kind, and it's helpful to have adoptee friends that I can reach out to who are going to help me just look past that and keep it moving. There is absolutely something profound that happens for adoptees being in relationship with one another. So I think you got to have that community support first.
Yeah. Could you talk a bit more about some of these like negative emails you were talking about?
Yeah, I often get people saying, like, back to the book title, why can't you just be grateful that you weren't aborted, for example. That comes up a lot. Why do you hate transracial adoption? Why do you hate white people? Which is not true. Neither are true. I don't believe that. I don't believe that transracial adoption can be abolished. I just do think that we aren't. The reason that transracial adoption is so common is because of a deep-seated belief that we don't feel like Black and Brown people can parent ourselves. And that is troubling. And so usually the messages I get are very individual. Like people feel like I am attacking them, when in reality, I'm talking about a system, a larger system that people are all a part of. And so there's a lot of fragility in the community, and I get the brunt of that.
Yeah. Just to end on a more positive note, your work as an author, filmmaker, and podcaster is definitely contributing to building a more understanding system, which will potentially trickle down to the individuals who can have a more comprehensive understanding of what the adoption experience is. Thank you so much for sharing with me, Angela. I am so grateful to be able to have this insightful conversation with you. I want to end by saying that your dedication to the openness of the cause, not only for adoptees, but for societal perception of what adoption is and what adoption is not, is just so inspiring. Is there anything else you want to add before we wrap up?
The thing I forgot to talk about, I think, was my work with the media. That's actually very exciting. I have a podcast coming out really soon where I interviewed the producers of Long Lost Family, a TLC show that did a really great job in centering adoptee reunions in an ethical way. And I enjoyed working with the writers of the TV show This Is Us, who really wanted to learn and get this character, Randall's character, accurate and correct. I loved working with Broadway's Jagged Little Pill, where the main character is a transracial adoptee. And this is all exciting to me because I do think that TV and kind of mass media has a huge influence on society, kind of the same way I was talking about storytelling being really important. And so that's another place where I would love to see more adoptees become involved as consultants on projects that have kind of mass appeal. So they're just to think that there's more than just legislation and ways to make really substantive impacts. So I forgot to add that.
Yeah, that is super exciting. I'm definitely going to continue following your work with storytelling and increasing portrayals in media. Thank you again for this conversation.
Thank you.